another Women of Letters podcast. I'm Amy, also known as Sweet Undine, and it's over to Sister Jules. Never going to stop that. Never going to stop it.
We're here this week to talk about the most recent episode of Supernatural, Alex, Annie, Alexis, Anne, which I am pleased to see people have already been referring to as the 4A episode.
Or I saw it as AAAAA, and I totally read it as ah, and then I went on a moment. I thought they were screaming about something. But yeah, I can never remember quite what order the names all come in. So. Well, let's just call it the 4As. That's much better.
I think the 4As is good. And this was, of course, written by Bob Behrens, who's been a new writer to Supernatural this year, and I think one that fans have been really happy with his episodes. Just to remind people, he did Heaven Can't Wait, which the big sort of a particularly Cass episode of his experience of humanity, and I think the other part of that storyline was around Crowley and Abaddon, and then we had the Captives, which was amazing episode where the trans were sort of reunited, and then back here with Alex, Annie, Alexis, Anne. I do like saying it because it does have a nice rhythm.
It does.
And I did want to mention up front, because we might forget it, I might forget it later on, was that the director was a new director to Supernatural. I will mangle his surname, which I think Polish, which is Stefan Plaszynski. And he'll be unfamiliar probably to most listeners. He has worked recently on Being Human, the show that I don't know where it's gone to. It's on some weird mid-season hiatus.
Is it even still on? Because when I was researching him too, I was like, he's got a huge TV pedigree, but he'd worked on Being Human, and then I was like, whatever happened to that show? Where'd that go?
It's on some weird long hiatus, I think, and Flashpoint, which some people will know, which is quite a good procedurally type thing. I particularly know him, and Canadians will, if they don't know his name, will know the series he worked on, which was Da Vinci's Inquest and Intelligence, which were both sort of investigative shows. Intelligence, if you ever get the opportunity to see it, is an amazing series set and filmed in Vancouver. So good pedigree, and I think he was a great addition to this episode, which drew heavily on a number of horror movies particularly. And I have to say, one of the wonderful things we've had this year is the writers live tweeting during the episodes. And little tidbits and insights into the writing process and the behind-the-scenes stuff. Of course, we've all also had the cast and crew tweeting and various sundry other people. And, I mean, Amy, what's it been like where we've got people like Orlando Jones and William Shatner live tweeting out the show?
I know, it's crazy. And I love William Shatner because he's so baffled by it all. And he's just so fun. I haven't finished yet. I've been listening to him on the Nerdist, on his podcast on there, and it's so good, but I haven't quite finished it. And Orlando, like, he's the fastest tweeter in the West. I mean, his little sorry, I just had to get up because my dog was walking off with my headphone cord and taking me with him. His little GIFs and memes and pictures that he tweets, he's so fast. How does he make that happen? He must just have a library. I think we've talked about this before, but it's hilarious.
He's astonishingly quick. Either that, or he's done a little bit of preparation. As someone who has done only a couple of live tweets, preparation before you live tweet is the key to good live tweeting, because it's sort of impossible to keep up otherwise.
Does he do the West Coast? Because I think he's probably watched the East Coast, prepped it, and then tweet the West Coast. That would be the way to do it.
Yes. Well, that's what. Yes, I think that would definitely be the way to do it. But it's like a DVD. We've had like DVD commentary on every episode. I do storify all the tweets, and you can find them on the episode linked on the episode pages on the wiki, because it's such a deep information that otherwise we wouldn't get about them. And
just fun too. I mean, you get Osric on there and just, you know, fun tweets as well as the really kind of good, really solid behind the scenes stuff that we also get from different members of the crew and cast. But yeah, also it's just fun. I always read them on when you storyfy them, because, you know, usually I'm at work when all this stuff's happening and I miss it all. So I always yes, you too. Yeah, I come home and watch the episode and then I'll go, now I'm gonna go read all the tweets, and they're all in one place, so I don't have to try and find them all out. It's good. Good. Thank you for doing that, Jules. It's awesome.
Oh, that's all right. I do. I mean, you know, I love the behind the scenes stuff, and particularly getting, you know, it's so rare for us to hear from the writers at all. So to be able to capture, little things about it. And, you know, we heard some great stuff before. You were mentioning where the inspiration for the episode came from before we came on air.
Yeah, it's the move. Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. They, because Robert was saying that Andrew Dabb and Robbie Thompson actually pitched the idea to him, and it was from a horror movie that I haven't seen. And they basically, what is it? It's all M's. It's all M names.
Marcy May Marlene.
Thank you. And I haven't seen it. I know you have. And it's got one of the Olsons, the eldest an Olson or something, you know, older Olson, somebody Olson.
Anyway,
thank you very much. And he was saying that they kind of went to him with the idea, and he said it was in one of his tweets, he said it was something that doesn't happen very often for a writer, but it completely formed in his head basically straight away as soon as they talked to him about the idea. So, yeah, it was very much a collaboration, these episodes are. It's not just one writer sitting at his typewriter going, tick, 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 like Metatron. It's like a whole gang of people work on it.
Definitely. And I mean, I think that happens. I mean, I don't know if people know a lot about it's a, but often writers will be assigned an episode and they'll be told this is going to be a Monster of the Week episode, or this will be a myth heavy episode, and it needs to happen at this part in the story, and it's going to be when, you know, Dean gets the first blade, and that might be all they have to build it around. Yeah. So
these are the things that you have to hit in this particular episode to get us to the next point.
And then the writer will normally, often in conversation with the other writers, come up with what they call a pitch for the episode, which will be the core idea. And then they go back to the showrunners, and it's usually, I believe, it's Supernatural. It's usually Bob Singer, Jeremy Carver, maybe Andrew Dabb, and the writers will go in and say, okay, this is how I see this episode coming. And they may have broken it down into scenes or into acts or scenes, and I'm sure they all have different ways of doing that. Anyway, back from that. Martha Marcy May Marlene, just briefly, is it's a wonderful sort of psychological horror movie about a woman who escapes from a cult she's been living with for a number of years, and you can immediately see the parallels with this story. And it's about her almost, I suppose, post-traumatic stress reactions to what's happened to her in that cult, trying to rebond with her family, and the stretched loyalties, if you like, that she has. So you can see how that sort of starts to play into exactly what we saw in this episode. But first of all, Jodie was back.
Yay! Now, yes, very good. And as soon as she comes into any episode, I get fretty, because I think, oh, my God, please don't be the one that they kill Jodie, because I really do love this character. I think she's had such a wonderful growth since we first met her in, was it Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid?
Yep.
Was that the episode? And, you know, when she was a sheriff who lost her family to, you know, being zombies, or her dead son rose and ate her husband.
As they do.
As happens. And then she's just, you know, really developed. We've seen her, you know, be this kind of character that had a really great relationship with Bobby, and then we lost Bobby, and she's developed what I think is a really lovely relationship with Sam over a couple of episodes. And, you know, and then has embraced the supernatural because it keeps hitting her in the face and she knows about it now, into who we saw in this episode, someone who is still so deeply damaged and sad over what has happened in her life and the grief that she carries. But, you know, this is completely, she's a completely changed person to the person that we first met. But it's been a really beautiful journey to watch her come to this point. And I love this character. I think this is, I think she's my favorite female character on Supernatural. I just think she's wonderful. And I adore Kim Rhodes. I just adore her. You know, she's wonderful. And I do have a big girl crush on her. So, you know, I just think she's awesome. So I would love to see more of her. So, yeah, it's great to have Jodie back. And she was once again kicking ass. And, but she's just, She's got a real depth to this character, and that's what I really enjoy as well.
And, you know, we've talked about this before, you know, how Supernatural does take characters that have been, you know, perhaps minor characters, and sometimes that magic happens and they decide to bring them back. And then over, you know, in this case, you know, we first met her in season 5. So here we are 5 seasons later.
I think this was the 8th episode that Jodie was in. I think I
yes, you're
out.
Right. Yeah. You are right. And, you know, so each bit has, you know, told part of her story. And I like it because it makes the supernatural world, if you like, it gives it depth because her story is going on out there, regardless of what's happening to the Winchesters, you know, her life. And I've talked, I think I mentioned this with Charlie and other characters in the past, and Garth even this season, that although for the Winchesters, the world does revolve around them, and it does for us as well, the fact that these people continue having their lives, they're not just in a stasis until the – which often happens
to
a character, you know, the grizzled old guy or whatever, or, you know, the Oracle or is just sitting around waiting for the heroes to turn up every, you know, season or second every couple of years, whereas here we have this real sense of her story continuing while they're away. And, you know, I love the fact that, you know, she's kept, you know, continued, obviously, you know, gone well in her job, even though she's had all these, you know, terrible things happen. It also gives a chance to see something we hear about a lot is the fact of how people become hunters. And, you know, we have seen, we saw a bit of that with Charlie, but, you know, and particularly with Jodie Mills, you know, we saw the initiating event that drew her into the world of the supernatural. She is, of course, someone with skills in, if you like, looking after herself and finding out things, detecting. So she was probably well primed in that area. But just to how that's become, you know, part of her life, so that now she's quite almost matter of fact when she opens the boot of the police car with a decapitated.
Oh, they grow up so quick. They grow up too quick, don't they? I love that little exchange.
It was gorgeous because, of course, she has. She has gone from someone who, you know, obviously an absolute mind spin to have your town overrun by zombies. But, you know, Jodie Mills has always come across as this very practical, pragmatic character. So, you know, that's been a part of her personality to deal with whatever shit comes her way. And very, very loyal. We saw that with Bobby, who she'd previously, you know, thought of as a bit of a deadbeat drunk.
And when she is
willing to, you know, put her job on the line to protect him and, obviously has a respect for, you know, Sam and Dean and what they do. And I like something that also these characters do is give us an outside perspective on the boys and get to see what they're like with other people, which, you know, let's face it, other than people they're rescuing or killing, as we've often said before, not a lot of friends in the Winchester world.
And there's a softness, like I've watched the episode a few times now, and I watched it just before we started doing this, and there's actually really softness to how they speak to Jodie. What I really liked in this episode too was that they straight off the bat they called her Jodie, and you know, in the past they have and they haven't, they've called a sheriff, and you know, but it's just Jodie now, you know, they've kind of got to the point where she's just Jodie, and which I thought was great, because you know, I'm pretty sure even in the last episode there was a bit of sheriff thrown around, but I watched how they spoke to her, and there is like this softness to how they speak to her, which I think I read as being like this, just a real respect for her. And I think, you know, that they, apart from being extremely fond of her, I think that they honestly respect her as, you know, as a law enforcer, as well as, you know, this person that she's become in their lives and the person that she's become in her own life. And their journey with her has been, you know, equally as satisfying as her journey, if you know what I mean. So it's she's great, and I'm so glad they didn't kill her.
And she's certainly proved herself, you know,
Over and over.
More than competent. I mean, last time we met her, she ends up killing Vesta, the goddess.
So, and I love the reference back to that House of Shoulder, you know, because she got jammed with whatever, I can't remember what she got stabbed.
Some sort of stake.
Stabbed in the shoulder with something or other. But, yeah, I mean, exactly. She's well and truly proved herself. And she's proved herself to be a good, loyal friend.
Yeah, and it's nice to see them have, and she's very much a peer almost now, if you like, and they're very, very few and far between, given the other people in their life have either disappeared off to Oz, been killed, or become a werewolf. So,
and that's what I was really worried about, because I was like, now, don't kill her, because, as you say, I'm assuming Charlie's going to come back from Oz in a blaze of something or other at some point next season, I'm assuming. So I don't think Charlie's gone forever, but basically Garth has gone because he's a werewolf, and he may or may not come back, but it sounded like he was, you know, they were saying goodbye because he's out of the hunter world now. And I was like, don't take Jodie as well, because they took Kevin, you know, so we were going back into a world where it was becoming really isolated. God knows these boys do not need to be jammed together, you know, and isolated at the moment, because they're, you know, really
functional. They do need to get out more.
They do. So I was concerned on it for, not just for a personal, you know, I really dig the character, and I totally think Kim Rhodes rocks it, and I think she's amazing. And so from those angles, obviously I didn't want her to a character that we'd lose, but it was really, as we say, that I feel like we need these characters in the Sam and Dean universe to give perspective to them that we see from the outside. And you know, once you take all that away, it becomes so claustrophobic, their relationship, which it already is, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, and there's, you know, really not that many people left, certainly
humans.
That have already, it's obviously any character you know, who's appeared in the show, but for ones that have already recurred, she's, you know, one of the very few remaining alive. So, you know, with ones they've already got a well-established relationship, yes, there's not many that they have around. So
no.
I think that's, you know, I feel sad for them. They need friends.
I feel sad for them too. You know, I always feel sad for them when they take these people away from them, because I get really excited when these new people are brought into their worlds, and I think, oh, yay, we're building up Sam and Dean's universe of people that they can trust and rely on and talk to, and you know, are just out there, that they just know there's people out there. If they need them, there are people out there, and then they pop them off one by one, and you end up and they've got nothing but each other, and that's not very healthy. Not, I mean, I know we all want, that's all we want for them, is just for them to love each other, but you know, it's really not very healthy, and particularly at the moment when one of them's, you know, consumed with First Blade rage and the other one's pissed off.
Well, yeah, and I think there is a point, a good point you make there, that they don't have anyone to turn to. They don't have anyone who can, you know, couple council, if you like. And, you know, really at the moment they've got Cass, and
he's kind of busy.
He's kind of busy, and they need to have a weekend together watching videos in the bunker or something, because really aside from him, they've only got Crowley. And, you know, when you're looking around and your BFF is Crowley, the only person you can pick up the phone to sort
that's
of have a
right.
deep and meaningful is Crowley, you're pretty fucked.
Yep, that's not right. Yep.
So I do feel, and, you know, I think both of them find it hard enough to open up, not people in their lives that provide that sort of emotional continuity is, you know, it makes it even harder for them. And I think the show's saying something about that too, that, you know, without those connections, the ones that you do have remaining have to bear so much more burden, you know, that Sam and Dean particularly have to be everything to each other because there's no one else there to provide it. And I think, personally speaking, that's a very difficult model for any, whatever sort of relationship it is. If you're expecting that other person to be your everything, that's a big burden to put on it when you've got no one else as a, you know, as a sort of a pressure release to talk to or anything.
And I think we've seen what a burden it is to their relationship, that, you know, as much as we know they're, you know, they're dysfunctionally joined at the hip and we love them for it, we've also seen what a burden that is on them both. That they only have each other.
Definitely, definitely. So to get to the actual plot of the episode, which we don't have to go through, we don't have to do a recap because we can do whatever we like. But we did start off meeting whether we want to call her Alex or Annie. And I have to shout out
or Alexis or Anne.
Yeah, Alexis Anne. Catherine Ramdean, the young actor who played this role, I thought, you know, and also Ashley Crowe, who played the mama vampire.
She was great.
I think the three of them, you know, really lifted this episode, because it was an interesting mix of a very character relationship based episode. Not it just wasn't the Winchesters. Relationships and a exciting horror story, if you like, but it needed that was this conflict between family, you know, between a, you know, about a dysfunctional family, really.
Something completely different.
It rested very heavily on the shoulders of Catherine Ramdean to be able to sell Annie as both sympathetic but also unreliable, if you like.
And she really did that. And I think that's – and we actually spoke about this last week, I know, but I think that's one thing that was so strong in this episode was that those performances – I mean, we always expect the Jays to knock it out of the park, and they did, but the performances of the three women in this episode was so strong, and, you know, you really believed in each and every one of them, and you believed in each and every one of them's their emotions. And I thought Kat did just I think she did an amazing job. I really liked her. I think she definitely sold the fact that, you know, you weren't sure how she was going to roll with the whole thing, but you kind of felt for her as well, and you didn't, you know, there was a level of sympathy for her character regardless of what she had done in the past. And, I thought the mother was great. And I had to look her up because I was like, man, who is she? She's so familiar. And she was in Heroes. She was the mum of the cheerleader, right? In Heroes.
Yes.
So I was like, oh, right, because she was bugging the hell out of me. But she was great too. Like, I thought she was really fabulous. And then the scene between the three of them at the end I thought was fantastic.
Oh.
Really, really powerful.
And I think that for me was the most tense moment, because as you mentioned, we always have fear for Jodie's longevity.
Yes.
So you don't know if she was going to be killed or turned or whatever, or whether the mother was going to kill Annie, or whether Annie was, you know, who was going to get killed. And then upstairs you've got Sam bleeding into a bucket. Which I have to say, I did think afterwards, I hope they didn't waste all that blood. I don't know what they should have done with it. But
it was Sam's. Oh, I thought when he tasted it, he was. I don't know what to say. I don't know what they would have done with it. Okay, you can't put it back in him. But I I would. I suppose they could use it for spells and things later. Pop it in the fridge, but or maybe if he needed it later. Actually, they should have probably bucketed it up for later when he needed a transfusion or something. Because God knows they must need a bit of a supply sometimes in the fridge when they, you know, get these massive injuries that, you know, fix overnight.
I should let listeners know that there are a couple of people working on for the wiki the number of times Sam has been knocked unconscious throughout the series, because it seems to have been happening with increasing frequency, and people are rug
Stavgun. How many was it? Sorry.
Oh, no, we haven't counted them yet, people have been someone's assembling all the throughout the season. Because if you remember back in the early years, Sam was always getting choked.
Yes,
but I suppose
was.
As they've got bigger, that is a bit harder now.
He's
so
too
they
tall.
Do.
You can't.
You need a long
Everybody
bit
needs
of wood
to stand on their
something.
Tippy toes, and you're not at your primary strength when you're on your tippy toes. But
says Amy, who often is trying to knock people out from behind, obviously.
All the time with a 2x4 like Dean got coinked with. I at least liked that Dean was knocked out this episode. So, you know, like Sam got tied up, must be Tuesday, as you always say. But at least Dean also got knocked out. I was like, okay, we've got a bit of equality here. They both got. But I was like sitting there going, these vampires are like the dumbest things on the face of the earth, monologuing, and you can bleed these guys out when they're dead, dudes. Just kill them and then bleed them out, you know?
Well, but it's turn it into dead man's blood if they're already dead.
Oh, you're quite right. I never even thought of that.
Oh, yes. I had quite a discussion on Twitter about...
No, you're right. I never thought...
What is the point when blood turns? So
I wonder what the point is when it turns. How dead do you have to be?
Exactly. So
how dead? Like there's levels of dead.
That's a clever
really good
story
point
in is. Actually keeping why they didn't kill them immediately was because they needed some travellers for the road.
I know they were packing picnic lunch. Gross.
Travellers. I don't know for people who aren't Australian. A traveller is a bottle of beer that you take
in the car.
When you're going on a road trip somewhere, and some people, not me, would measure the length of a trip by how many travellers you need.
Yep.
A bit of Australian trivia.
That's
there.
Take a traveller on a road trip.
Anyway, so where do we want to go back to? So I suppose one thing that this episode really did, you know, continue is the show's ongoing sort of exploration of family and what family is. How do you think it did with that?
Well, you know, apart from the fact that I was like, wow, this vampire mum's a bit pervy because she's only turned all these kind of like young hot boys. I was like, what's that about?
Like you wouldn't do exactly the same thing yourself.
Of course I would. Of course. What else would I do? But no, exactly. I mean, they had formed their family, and that's also another ongoing theme with all the vampires that we've met. Because they live in nests, they create their own family unit. And she had done the same, but she hadn't turned Alexis, Anne, Annie, Alex, because of what we found out later, that, you know, she was hanging on to the memory of an Alex that had passed. But there was that, and of course then there was also Jodian and her connection to Annie and how she related to her, which, you know, I think it was both an exploration of family and grief, I think, and how Jodie was dealing or not dealing with the grief of losing her son, and what that then brought into this relationship with this young girl, because she wanted to protect her, you know, against everything coming from that sort of place of loss. And then, of course, yeah, building... I mean, I got a definite sense that they were building something at the end in their last conversation when Jodie was, I will be here for you, and if you want me to be here, I'll be whatever you need me to be, if you need me to be that. And you got a definite sense that they were building their own sort of little family unit. And I personally love how the show represents family. I find that really profoundly satisfying, and I think a lot of the fandom does as well, and I think that's part of, you know, how the fandom comes together as a community, and we talk about it all the time, that we're supernatural family or whatever. But I really love the take on family, that it's not necessarily you build your family out of the people in your life that you love, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the people that gave birth to you. And yeah. I really love the statement that the show makes about that, and it continues even through with the monsters, which I think is really interesting as well.
I've always liked the author Armistead Maupin, known for his Tales of the City books, refers to it as the logical family and the biological family, which I always thought was a fun way of putting it. But yeah, I think the other thing I always like is, even within this broadening of the definition of family to include those people you have, you know, this a close relationship with. And I mean, of course, it's been brought into very sharp focus this season because it's Sam who turned around to Dean and said, you know, well, when they had that conversation at the end of The Purge?
The one before,
when he says, Dean says, oh, you know, look, basically, well, we're family, you know, we'll get over it. And Sam says, that's not a magic cure-all for everything, and that, you know, we can work together and keep hunting together, but our relationship, if you like, he says as brothers, but, you know, our emotional relationship doesn't just get fixed because we're related. So that's not, you know, it's not sacrosanct and it's not magical that because you're related to someone. And of course, in this episode, they have another sort of blood relationship, if you like. The show never romanticizes family. So even within this constructed family, whether it's a vampire family or whether it's the family the Winchesters have constructed, it isn't ever romanticized or sentimentalized as being something that fixes everything or is magically wonderful. It's not just, yes, if we, you know, we all get together and we're all besties, then we can overcome everything. You know, a main part of the show is looking at how hard those relationships are to make work and to keep working. And I think that's something that you often, or I should say that you rarely see explored, you know, on television. It's usually about people coming together, sometimes about things coming apart, but it's rarely this sort of hard slog of constructing family in that way.
And I think it's a, and I think it's a realistic take on family, and I also think it's a very contemporary take on family, because I think, you know, a lot of people these days make their family out of their community, and not necessarily, or they may still have family connection to their blood family, but they also create family out of community. And so I think it's a really relevant take that the show has on family.
Even the family people grow up in these days, it often comes together not from the parents who gave birth to them, but there's people repartner once or even more during that time. So you have other siblings come in and other parental figures. You know, that's something we still struggle with, is how that works. I mean, I have a number of friends who have partnered with people who have children of varying ages from other relationships. So, you know, they become an instant parental figure and, you know.
Yeah. I've had that happen with my friend group too. It's an interesting thing to have to deal with.
So that can, and as you say, and then there's other people who, you know, who see as their family perhaps broader parts of a community, whether that's a, you know, fanish community or wherever else, or their friendship groups.
Yep.
So yes, I do think it's a very contemporary, I think you pinned it down very well there, Amy, in that being a very contemporary take on family, and I think importantly not minimizing how difficult that is, whatever it looks like to you, and that sometimes even dysfunctional or abusive families, as we saw in this episode, can still be the best, if it's the best thing you've got in your life, can still be very hard to get out of.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that in itself is a very relevant statement to, you know, what a lot of people experience in relationships and tragically experience in relationships. And, so, I mean, I've always really appreciated the show's take on family. It's been one of the things that I like about the show the most. And every time they show any kind of extension of it, and I really appreciate the fact that they do show that monsters also, you know, have these kind of connections, and it sort of brings everything down onto a very similar, onto the same level, if you know what I mean. You know, they might be monsters, they're not humans, but we're all kind of, that they can still be operating on the same level in many ways in their connection with the people within their lives.
Yes. And I think the other thing, and I know we have spoken about this before, probably in Bob Behrens' last episode, The Captives, has been the show's ongoing exploration of grief and what that is. Mm-hmm. And I think the standout thing that Supernatural has done is not, as most shows do, have grief be something you experience in a moment, in reaction to an event, usually a death, but that grief is an ongoing thing. It's a process, and that the impact it has on your life, you know, continues and changes and doesn't go away. And I thought that was it was great the way they brought that forward with Jodie. And it wasn't a surprise, because we have seen, you know, these things she talked about, of how she's tried, you know, integrate the horrible things that happened to her family into her life. And I think that scene where Alex asks her about how did your family die, and she just goes, horribly. I mean, that was a moment. The acting in that one word from Kim Rhodes was just...
That was amazing.
The grief and the... I mean, you just got her whole history.
In one word.
In that one moment, and how still how raw and present that loss is for her half a dozen years later.
Of course, which as you say, she is amazing. And can you hear me? Sorry. Which, yes, as you say, is really relevant, because grief doesn't just evaporate like it does on television. You know, it hangs with you and catches you in the most unexpected moments. I mean, anybody who's suffered loss knows that, you know, you can be driving down the street and suddenly go, and just get overwhelmed by just out of the blue. And I like that they acknowledge that grief is an ongoing process, and it's something that affects everybody differently. You know, anger and also it can affect you differently in different moments. So, you know, you can be angry or you can be sad or whatever, and that the way they explore grief in this show is very real, just as, you know, I think the way they explore family and the way they explore the relationships, it, you know, it's a very true exploration of grief. And when she said horribly, it was just so gut-wrenching. It was because, you know, her family did die horribly, and that must just be something that haunts her all the time. And, you know, to that one word, you're right, it was massively powerful and such a wonderful performance by Kim. But yeah, and it, you know, reflects back then once again on the boys, which is what, as you say, we use these characters often to reflect back on the boys, of the kind of grief that they constantly are carrying with them as well. And and certainly this season they're dealing with a major grief, and they seem to be every season, let's face it. But
losing
this season's
Kevin's
grief.
Yeah, losing Kevin is something that's been brought up, you know, again and again.
And it's still a powerful pain, you know, in both of them, and also a wedge between them. And so, you know, having the way Jodie spoke about how you try to fill that hole of grief, and, you know, you look at the guys of how they try to fill that hole. They keep working, or they, you know, they drink, or, you know, whatever they're doing to try and fill their hole of grief. And, you know, it was just a very powerful recollection of what grief can mean. And certainly for the Winchester brothers, they've seen so much of it.
And I think the other thing struck me, particularly on, it sort of, I got a bit of it the first time I watched, and then more the second time. And of course, we have that conversation after the boys get to the cabin, and Jodie's been knocked out, and Alex has been taken by the vampires, and they're arguing that, you know, she's compromised, you know, she's obviously, you know, can't be trusted, and is sort of now going to be part of the hunt, if you like, or at the very least, you know, she's collateral that doesn't really matter. And Jodie's arguing that, you know, they have to give her a chance. And what struck me was not just their conclusion, because I think that's almost reasonable given their history, that, you know, seeing her as a hostile, if you like, because that's how you don't get killed. But what really struck me was, compared to Jodie, I just had this moment of feeling how hardened they were. And of course, given everything that's happened to them and the job they do, that's, you know, again, certainly not surprising. But I just had this moment thinking, you know, how much their humanity lost over the years through necessity and through what's been done to them. And I felt bad. It just felt like, you know, it's like they've been scarred so many times that that's, you know, that's permanent now. It's not something that they can bounce back from. And I remember, you know, you remember back to, you know, to Dean in season one saying to Sam, you know, the things I'm willing to kill or do for you and Dad scares me sometimes. Now that's long gone, you know, and
he's not scared of that stuff anymore. I mean, they just do what they feel like they have to do. And we know that Dean is coming from a slightly different space at the moment, but you know, even when he was saying, you know, Jodie was saying, well, you're not going to kill her. And Sam was like, well, no. And Dean was like, well, not yet. And Sam's like, not. He didn't jump in and go, well, no, Dean, we're not, you know, like Sam in the past would have, because I think Sam was standing there thinking, well, yeah, you know, we might have to kill her. And you're right. Their life is so extreme. And they have to become desensitized to what's going on in their world. Otherwise, you know, they would be batshit crazy by now, if they're not batshit crazy anyway. But,
well, yeah. Yeah, and I do think, though, it is something, talking about grief, and maybe that was part of my response, is that there is something that they have lost through all this. You know, and I remember the scene in Croatoan back in season two when Dean wants to kill someone that they think has been turned by the virus, and Sam's arguing not, and says, and Dean's, you know, being very black and white, and Sam says, you know, this stuff is hard, we are meant to struggle with it, that's the point. And that they don't even have that, and certainly that, you know, that still continues, and they still have to make these decisions about which monsters to kill and which not to kill. I mean, we saw it recently with the I can't say it without laughing, the fish taco, about whether to kill her or, you know, let her go back to where she come from. But they make those decisions. It's not I don't get a sense that they're wrestling with it. It's a pragmatic decision to make, of risk, each person could do versus, you know, so there's a balance, you know, a ledger they're keeping, you know, weighing up there.
It doesn't feel like an ethical
or moral
dilemma
quandary they have. No. It is more a pragmatic risk assessment, if you like. And I did feel quite sad that through this process, you know, we talked about, and without saying they're going down this path at all, but, you know, demons are made through their humanity being removed. So that there's a sense that, you know, I do feel that they've lost something. And even if they can't get that back, I do think they can get something back that's different but similar, if you like. And I think probably the core to that is repairing their relationship at the moment and getting – and I think maybe some of the difficulty they have with their relationship is also this, you know, I think I wrote rather in some prose in my review that it's like scar tissue over their heart, that, you know, they need somehow to be able to break through that to repair their relationship. Now, I suppose the other side of that is, does that make them more vulnerable in the world that they're operating in now as well? But, yeah, anyway.
Just because
the show's not depressing enough, I have to find the aspects of it that are really, really even more depressing.
No, but you're right, because in, you know, in the last, like, four seasons, let's say, you know, since Sam got back from hell, let's say, you know, there has been this kind of distancing themselves from the moral dilemma and this much more black and white, you know, even though there's been, you know, they've had monster friends and things like this, that there's been this, you know, almost emotional cutoff that they have towards the job that they do, which I think is, you know, a reflection of their emotional cutoff from each other, which, you know, they haven't been emotionally connected now for, you know, seasons, let's face it. And I think that's very much part of it. I think what you're saying there, you know, is right on. You know, if they can find their way back to repairing something in their relationship that would give them back a level of humanity within the job, whether that makes them more vulnerable or not, they kicked ass pretty well right at the beginning when they were, you know, less harsh.
As we were just talking about, you know, with grief, you know, in some ways that they've been, you know, one of the things that's happened to them is not just, you know, the physical and torment and that they've been through, but having all these people die one after another, I can't imagine, you know, what that has, you know, it would be a survival to limit your sense of connection with people.
And I think that's right. It's got to be probably like a cutoff that, you know, like, I don't know, you know, like you hear about, you know, people who work in emergency services and stuff like that saying, you know, they've just got to be able to do the job because they can't think about it. And I think that's kind of, it's almost like where the guys have got to, you know, they can't think about it. They can't think about all the loss and they can't think about what they're doing because then they can't continue to do it. And this is what they do. And it has, it's completely cut away a part of who they are. As individuals and as brothers, I think. And I think, you know, like, I think repairing their relationship would give them back some level of connection, at least, you know, there. But, I mean, you know, like, they're connected. You can see they're still, you know.
Oh, well, you can see that, you know, when you know, Dean runs to Sam, you know, without even thinking of Jody, hello.
He's straight to Sam to unplug him. You know, unplug
Sam
him.
Has to actually say,
Jody. Oh, yeah, shit. And he still unplugs her and still unplugs Sam anyway. And then, you know, I love that when they come down the stairs, you know, Sam's holding on to Dean all the way down. So, you know, like there's still this epic connection between them that's never going to go away, no matter how much they fight it or how much they say it's not there. It's just their natural, you know, who they are, and they naturally fall to each other.
Notice Dean got the dig in, you know, when he is going to Sam and Sam sort of says, you know, gets his attention, and Dean's like, oh, what, you wouldn't do the same for me? It's like, oh my God, Dean,
Dean, stop it. I know, I was like, oh, Dean, stop it, you bitch. You know.
We did have a couple of questions I did want to make sure we covered from the interwebs today. And one of the couple of these tie into what we're just talking about. One's from M94 on Twitter, who said, when Dean said, look at me, bitch, as he's about to kill the vampire, did you think it was hot or were you worried for his sanity or both?
Oh, I thought it was, well, both, let's face it. No, it was really, really hot. And I've had a lot of conversations on Twitter about how disturbed we all are with ourselves.
Yes.
We think maybe Mark of Cain Dean is even hotter than Purgatory Dean, which is almost impossible.
Or getting towards the end, Thigh Holster Dean.
Oh, which is just... I'm sorry. Did I just make that noise out loud?
I did actually tweet out during the week that it says something about the perversion of our fandom that, you know, I think it was a pretty even break about whether people were more turned on by naked Dean in the shower or Dean killing, you know, decapitating a vampire with the blunt edge of a machete.
Yeah, he used the other edge.
And then, of course, some people pointed out if he had done that while in the shower,
God bless. That's hilarious. That would have been, oh, I don't know about that. That would have been weird, quite frankly. But
but I do
I'm just
think,
picturing that in my mind now, and I need to get rid of that because that's strange.
Well, I do remember actually last week when there was a lot of talk, obviously, and adulation towards writer Robbie Thompson about the shower scene, that he did make a he made a comment that in I've immediately forgotten the name of the movie. Robbie Thompson made a comment that next season there would be a sauna scene a la Eastern Promises, which is a movie Viggo Mortensen does, which has a really bloody fight scene with naked tattooed men in a wet sauna. So
that's really funny, because I have a conversation with someone on Twitter about how we think the Men of Letters needs a steam room. And why has why haven't we seen that?
Well, there you go. Maybe if Robbie keeps his promise, we'll get a bloody fight scene in it. But I do think, I mean, I think it's interesting that many people, and I think it's aside from speaking for myself, who's not sexually attracted to Dean, but I did get a big turn on from that scene. I think it's when we see Dean taking, in a funny way, Dean taking control, but he's also losing control, yeah. And he's using the voice. He's that dominance thing that he has in that scene, I think, is
like,
you know,
Dean.
Incredibly, you know, it's a big turn on. And I think we don't see that, you know, for all their fight scenes and that, I think, and people mentioned it, we had a little bit of it from Sam last week too, when they capture Gadriel.
Yeah.
And Sam says, you know, remember me?
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
A bit, you know, a bit like we've talked about the sparse use of nudity, that those moments when the boys really lose control while taking control, if you like, are quite few and far between. And I think they're very powerful, because, and they do remind you of what they can do, which is also why, you know, Purgatory Dean was, and the essence of Dean. I mean, he reminisced about how pure that was and how much he enjoyed that. And I think that's the scary thing about...
They're really scary dudes.
And the effect of the mark of Cain, in a way. I mean, he got the mark, you know, I know people seem to have forgotten. He got the mark because he's a good killer. Cain gave it to him because of that in him. You know, he didn't get the mark because he's pretty or, you know, anything else. He got, or he's good, he got the mark because he's a killer. And it's almost as if it's you know, Sam had that commentary at the end about, you know, dude, you're enjoying it a bit too much, and I know, and people mentioned, well, you know, Dean, it's not the first time you've seen Dean. I think it's the first, might be the first time, maybe not quite absolutely first, but, you know, he, it's essential, Dean, is to be able to enjoy killing without consequences. And I think that's why he enjoyed Purgatory.
Feeling shitty
black
about
and white,
it. Because,
black
yeah.
and white.
Yeah.
You're bad. You need to die. You're
I'm
a monster.
Feel okay about it.
I can kill you. And that's what he had in Purgatory, was the ability to do that.
And not beat himself up.
Yeah. So I think that's the scary thing, is not that the mark of Cain is taking Dean to a place that's not Dean. It's taking it to a place, you know, we are talking about the dude who tortured people in hell for 10 years.
Yeah.
So there's
it's
a dark...
taking him to a place of Dean that, you know, he tries to keep buried.
Yes. So I think that realization actually was quite scary for me, because I thought that makes it even harder in a way.
And I think it's a place that Dean's well aware of as well. And I mean, he's commented on it before about how he feels like, you know, he's nothing more than a killer in these very vulnerable moments of him. I think he knows deep inside, not dear God, that nobody chastised me. Not that I think Dean Winchester is nothing more than a killer. I think he's, you know, I think you all have a pretty good idea that I think, you know, I think a lot more of Dean Winchester than that. Kind of made that obvious, but I think this is what Dean, you know, this is the guts of who Dean thinks he is, you know, and it's almost like he's giving over to it. And I think it's a very big part of who Dean is. It was who he's been raised to be in many ways. And I
think, again, that's an interesting, just to go back to some of the, you know, complex ideas the show explores, is, you know, and in, you know, I think Jungian psychology, it's referred to as the shadow self. You know, what is that part of yourself that, you know, you want to deny and you try and keep separate, and is integrating that some way into who you are, you know, the path to becoming, you know, fully actualized. We saw that Dean, after purgatory, really seemed to have become a lot more at peace and happy is not quite the right word, but at he was peace, okay. He was copacetic with the fact that killing things is what he is meant to do. It's what he's good at. It's what he enjoys, not a destiny or a fate or anything, or he's trying to balance the ledger in the universe. He wants to kill evil things and he enjoys killing evil things. But how then you separate that from your own notion of yourself as, gee, my main reason for living is to kill things, is a difficult thing. You know, there is a dark side to that. There's a loss in that. There's, you know, it's not just about, you know, I can say I've saved people, because, you know, you've also, what, as many people have died. So
which
I think
might
that
be where we're going with him, is that, you know, he's kind of just giving over to that side of his personality, which we know is there, but we know that there's, you know, as you say, there's the other side that just desperately wants to save people, and there's, you know, the side that he's so many sides, he's so deep, but yeah. So, don't even stop me. But, you know, sorry. But I could go for hours, and we already go for long enough. But, you know, I think
Bobby spelled it out very eloquently with the character of Cain. Cain killed his brother because of how much he loved him, and that led to him Cain becoming the, you know, forming the Knights of Hell. So, I mean, really that's the essence of Dean too.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, it's his love for his brother is core to him. But will that be enough to stop bad shit happening, basically?
I don't know. I hope so. That's what we're all hoping for. I also have to say he's massively strong. You know, like, I mean, I love the look on the vampire's face when he kind of, the vampire's like, I've so got this. And he's like pushing the blade toward Dean's throat. And Dean kind of like suddenly like, you know, I call it, I activate the mark of Cain. It's like Power Twins activate. You know, he activates the mark of Cain and he suddenly pushes back. And the look on the vampire's face was like, what the fuck? You know, I'm like, I'm supposed to be doing this, and just flips him around. And I mean, he's becoming so strong, and I'm, you know, I think Jensen's been working out as well, so he looks bigger and everything, working out more. And I think that's really interesting too. So it's like it's a very physical thing that's happening to him with the mark of Cain, not just an emotional thing, a very physical thing. Just interesting, but yeah.
So we probably should wrap it up. There's so much to say, and I can't wait to see. We've got, of course, four episodes to go. Next week is Bloodlines, which is the
pilot.
planted pilot. I'm saying that because...
Or embedded. You can also call it the embedded pilot.
Or I could call it the backdoor pilot.
But that sounds dirty.
Then we can both giggle like 12-year-olds. This is the bottom. And look, I know that I'm excited to see what they do with this. It's an Andrew Dabb written episode. It's a big thing for the show to be doing, to be planting a spin-off. They did get to film in Chicago, and so we've seen some of the stills from that this week, which looked awesome.
They look great. And that beautiful shot of Sam and Dean snuggling on the front seat as they drive through Chicago. Sam, move over, buddy. Why are you sitting so close?
Hand
shush. I know,
sorry,
what you, I know.
But look, I know that some people are frustrated because, of course, we're at a very crucial point in the myth arc as well with the Mark of Cain, and that in some ways this will be tangential to that. But we then have three Shit Get Real episodes to follow, which are going to be all myth arcs. So.
Which is not unusual in a season either. If you go back and look at the season, that's pretty standard that we kind of crack it up in the last few eps.
Yeah, I mean – traditionally episode 9, actually usually 17 and 19 have often been standalones, and it's 18, 20 and 21 back when, or 22, back when we had only 22 episodes. We get 23 now, luckily. I think the last three episodes, given the little bit of synopsis we've read, are going to kill us.
They're going to kill us. I've already decided that. I've decided that they will kill me. These episodes. But I'm really looking forward to it, which is, you know, just how twisted Supernatural makes us all. Because we're like going, one, I don't want a hiatus because boo. Two, this is going to be massively painful and I know it and it's going to hurt my heart. And three, I can't wait. I'm really excited.
Yes, all of those things. And we should say it's actually a bit of an auspicious day today. So it's the Impala's birthday.
Woohoo!
Very coincidentally not Eric Kripke's birthday.
Not coincidentally.
And it's also the last day of filming for season 9.
It is.
So I believe cocktails and last Jared tweeted.
Aged barreled cocktails.
Yes.
What does that mean?
3 hours ago, Deep South Barrel apparently make whiskey. So that's all I can tell you about.
And it's just amazing to me that it's the last day of their shooting today. Yep. And because
184 days of shooting.
And it just feels like this whole season has just gone. I mean, I don't know if it's just my year has gone real quick or if everybody feels like this, but it really has felt super quick. And, you know, when Jim Michaels tweeted that today, I was like, I mean, I knew it because I knew this was their last week, but I was still like, God damn, where'd this season go, man?
Four episodes left. This is another little people did comment last week on our little moment of taking fandom to task. So I'm going to – just a little bit of advice from me this week, fandom. Enjoy this. Enjoy the show being on air. Shows don't last forever. Whether we've got another year, whether there's more after that, I don't know. But soak this up. Soak up having a new episode every week. We've got 4 more for the season. Enjoy having the writers and the cast and the crew tweeting along with us, and William fucking Shatner as well.
It's it's such a rare experience to have that kind of thing.
And as someone who's, you know, I've been in other fandoms in the past, and, you know, fandoms continue long after, of course, shows are finished, but it's never the same as that excitement of having a new episode each week and not knowing what's going to happen to these characters that we love.
Just
so,
love having your boys on the telly.
Yeah. So crack open a window, chill out, and enjoy this shit because it's pretty amazing.
It's pretty damn amazing, and we're pretty damn lucky.
I do just want to add in, of course, even though filming's finished, VFX and post-production have got another month's work of work to do.
I want to also add in that filming's finished, which means we might get hiatus beards photos.
Well, you might have to give the boys at least the weekend to grow their
beards.
Come on,
they've got a lot of testosterone, those two, I reckon. I reckon they just they like, have. Grow well, I think we've got beards.
DC Con coming up in a week or two. Yeah.
And then the Rome Con.
Yeah, so we'll know in a couple of weeks
how beardy they are,
Amy. but yes, please, everyone, do keep sending out some love to the VFX team and anyone from post-production that's on Twitter. You can find a list of everyone and what their jobs are on the front page of the wiki, supernaturalwiki.com. So please, because I know last year they were all working up until a couple of days before the finale aired, including weekends. Mm. So if they are on Twitter, it's probably because
they were doing those beautiful angels falling.
Yes. They need a little bit of entertainment and love abuse. Yep. Around. I've been Jules.
And I've been Amy. And this has been another Women of Letters, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.